Welcome to another episode of New Books in Terrorism and Organized Crime. Today we have Ian Grillo, who is on the line from Mexico City, and we're talking about his new book, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Hi, Ian, how are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you doing?
Good, good, good. We're over here in Brisbane from my side, and you're in Mexico City. And this is probably the first time I've actually spoken to someone in Mexico City. So how is everything over there at the moment? I suppose we're going to really talk about that as we discuss the book.
Sure, yeah. Well, it's in the evening now, in a rainy season, a bit of a rainy day in Mexico City. Yeah, with traffic kind of getting towards rush hour traffic time. So, yeah. All good.
All good. We're having a wonderful Brisbane winter's day where we're going to hit 27 degrees Celsius. So all good here as well. So, Ian, let's start off just by if you could explain how you ended up in Mexico City, because as you can tell by your accent, you're obviously not from Mexico, and how you end up writing this book.
Well, I'm originally from Brighton in the UK. I came to Mexico in 2000, keen to do journalism in Latin America, and I was very attracted to Latin America by the culture, and also seeing some of the movies from back in the 80s, like Salvador, and hearing about the courage of the civil wars in Central America back in the 80s. When I came to Mexico in 2000, it was a very different narrative, a very different set of events going on. We were talking about the kind of emergence of democracy in all these countries, the end of military dictatorships, the end of guerrilla movements, and then this kind of 21st century end of history, you know, new bright capitalism all around the world. And so I came to Mexico and back in 2000, and then became interested in drug cartels and the drug trade. Partly growing up in Brighton, England, is a place with a very high consumption of drugs. Back in the 80s, there's a lot of heroin there, a lot of ecstasy in the 90s, and cocaine and so forth. And knowing several young men or teenagers who died of heroin overdoses back then. So arriving in Mexico and Latin America, which were countries which produced and trafficked drugs, I was very interested in this relationship between communities like where I came from, where there's very high consumption of drugs, and communities which were involved in trafficking and producing drugs. And it's very interesting to me, this kind of international phenomenon, part of the global trade, the kind of globalization is the drug trade, but is among different countries, and obviously all politics is local. And politicians have struggled to really contain this. And as I covered this drug trade and started to look, you know, follow the tentacles to the places where drugs were first began, grown as opium poppies to make heroin, the meth labs importing the ingredients, going to Colombia to look at how the cocaine was produced, eventually meeting traffickers, meeting assassins, meeting criminal lawyers, working with drug traffickers and so forth, and getting close to the cartels. And as I was doing this, there became a real surge of violence from about 2006 onwards, when President Felipe Calderón took power and declared a national war or national offensive on drug cartels and sent 96,000 soldiers against them, and 16,000 Marines and 39,000 federal police. And when you had these, you know, offensive armed forces, the cartels hit back, and you had this explosion of violence and really a low-intensity war erupting in Mexico, which now has claimed more than 70,000 lives, as well as there being more than 20,000 cases of people have disappeared. So I was continuing to cover this, and there was big interest from many international news outlets, from Australian TV to British TV to Japanese TV to all the big American networks and magazines and so forth. And then often people would end up coming to me to ask them to produce stuff with them, and news reports, short documentaries, and that kind of thing. And I realized that it was a story I couldn't cover, or a story I couldn't tell often in these short news reports, in these short articles, or even magazine articles. It was so big. I proposed this book, and Bloomsbury, who are the same publishers who published Harry Potter, picked up on this and and bought the idea and support me to go ahead with this project, which, in fact, the book is actually called, as you say, it's called El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency is the US title. The Australian and the British title is actually El Narco, The Bloody Rise of Mexican Drug Cartels. A bit of a different take there. And it's also been published in Poland, in France. Italian rights have been sold, and in many other markets, like India and so forth, English-speaking markets.
Yep. I mean, it's quite prestigious that you're on the same publisher as Harry Potter, because the story that's in this book seems like a fantasy land for someone, certainly from a Western country like Australia or the United States. It's just so strange, because we tell the listeners what you're actually covering here is not just the history, you're actually talking about the culture of what's going on in Mexico with this particular change in the last 10 years, is it 20 years that we're talking about?
Well, there's certainly been this massive change in Mexico. Really, the one key was the move in Mexico from a one-party state, which there was one party in power, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, from 1929 till 2000. And it ran at times every single state. You know, in its heydays, it had almost, you know, every single mayor in the country and the president's office. And so really kind of one-party system compared to the Soviet Union in some ways, with its hold on power. But also it was called by one Latin American Nobel Prize winner, Mario Vargas Llosa. It was dubbed the perfect dictatorship, in that it could hold on to power but still have elections every 6 years, maintain the facade of democracy, change the person at the top, and have, you know, quite a functional country in many ways. And there was a big change to a multi-party system, which we've had since 2000, with a change in the presidency, and really since the late 90s in various states. And so you've got a system with all kinds of different power bases. And that's part really of tragically, a similar thing happened when the Soviet Union collapsed. You started to get this great monolith of power collapsed or broke down or fragmented. And within that, many people who worked in security forces or for the state defected and started working for drug cartels, started working as mercenaries. And many things that before been the realms of the state, like shaking down business. The state had before seen, you know, it's right, you know, it could always shake down a business for money. The cartels moved into that area as well. And they started really challenging police, challenging the army over the monopoly of violence in parts of the country, and really became kind of criminal warlords. As well as that, as you point out, there's also a kind of rise in the culture of the drug cartels, of drug traffickers, from a whole music genre subsidized by drug cartels. I mean, you know, literally they pay for these songs to be made, called narco ballads, drug ballads, and also kind of a weird religion or quasi-religious beliefs funded as well by drug cartels, from something called La Santa Muerte, which is the Holy Death, which is also venerated by some ordinary people, a kind of skeletal grim reaper figure, but many drug traffickers will venerate her, as they refer to her. To another group, one group called La Familia, Michoacana, whose founder, known as the maddest one, El Más Loco, even wrote his own kind of Bible and was a kind of a preacher as well as a drug trafficker. So some very strange changes in Mexican society. And like you say, the whole thing can be very surreal. Mexico is a very surreal country. Salvador Dali was said to have said that when he came to Mexico, he didn't like it because it was even more surreal than his paintings. so it's definitely a strange place for many people who live here or from here also find it quite a strange, surreal place.
Yep. The rise of the drug cartels, too, coincides with the fall of the drug cartels in Colombia, from your story as well. So the American pressure on Colombia pretty much creates a new market or the opportunity for the Mexican cartels to pick up the slack from the Colombian cartels as they're coming apart. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, and people, analysts of the drug trade, talk about the balloon effect as the drug trade being like one big balloon, and when you put pressure on one part, the air simply rushes somewhere else. And that's very true. when the Colombian, major Colombian cartels collapsed in the 90s with the killing of Pablo Escobar in 1993 and then the arrest of the leaders of the Cali cartel by 1997, the Mexicans grew in power. And the big money from cocaine moved from Colombia to Mexico. So the Colombians became simply suppliers of the Mexicans. They would sell them the bricks, the kilo bricks of cocaine for some $2,000 or $3,000. And then the Mexicans would move it to the US where it could be sold wholesale for some $30,000 and then sold in the street for some $100,000 or even more. Then the Colombians, in some ways, were happy to retreat from the business because the US were putting pressure on them, as you say. But also they saw the growing market in Europe. So they thought, well, we can still unload this to the Mexicans for a couple of $1,000s and we can focus on Europe where we're getting paid in euros and where the European demand for cocaine is going through the roof, especially in England, Spain and Italy.
Yep. But of course the market in Mexico, the production market isn't just cocaine. It's a full suite of drugs, effectively. It's marijuana, it's meth, it's heroin as well.
Yeah, that's correct. The big four drugs, marijuana, cocaine, crystal meth, and heroin, are all handled by Mexican cartels. They buy the cocaine from the Colombians or from other places in South America. They become massive producers of crystal meth. And this gets back into the balloon effect again. Crystal meth used to be produced mainly in the United States itself, often by biker gangs and so forth. Cooking it up in bathtubs or, you know, on these mobile places in the desert like you see in Breaking Bad. But when there was laws in the United States to try and crack down on this and crack down on the precursor ingredients like suephedrine, these different chemicals they would buy to make into crystal meth, they started clamping down on those that moved down to Mexico. In Mexico, they would create these super labs and import from all around the world these precursors. And had these massive super labs where you see, you know, in industrial scale production of crystal meth. And heroin, again, as he says, has been produced for a long time. Black tar and Mexican mud, as it's known as. And marijuana is produced in absolutely colossal quantities as well. From large swathes of Mexico, you can see big marijuana plantations.
Yeah. So how about when we next move to a quick scan of who the major groups are and then talk about the plazas and the war over the access to the plazas and what the plazas are, I suppose.
Well, the major groups in Mexico, when you get deeper into the cartels, you can see them often more as federations rather than top-down organizations. I think that's quite important. Often, we think of or the way that the media often paint these cartels or the DEA patents cartels trying to make their cases is like, companies, as we'd understand, a company like, a very top-down company like Microsoft or something. But really, they're more federations you often see. So you can often see the gangsters run like franchises of them and sharing resources and sharing kind of brand name. But in Mexico now, you have the two biggest groups, or the biggest group of all is the Sinaloa cartel. Which is a big federation of gangsters and traffickers, assassins and so forth, with its roots all the way back almost 100 years to when the United States first started restricting opium in 1914. There was opium come from Sinaloa state in the northwest of Mexico to the U.S. So in some ways, it's like Sicily, is to the Italian organized crime. So Sinaloa is to Mexican organized crime. And one of their top guys is Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, who was for a while on the Forbes billionaire list at the rate of $1.00 billion. Although I and many others have serious doubts about their science for calculating that figure, and he's since been taken away from that because they realised it was kind of bad science and maybe morally not a good idea to put drug traffickers on their list. And then on the other side, you have a group called the Zetas, which are very different. They're a much younger organization. They were founded in 1998 as a small group of enforcers for other drug cartel known as the Gulf Cartel. But they grew and grew. They were first founded by 14 former members of the Mexican military who defected to join the cartel. And they grew and grew and eventually broke away from the Gulf Cartel between about 2007 and 2010. 2010, they finally cut the links and went to full-scale war with the Gulf Cartel and spread in a very startling way across Mexico into Central America, in places like Guatemala. And as well as trafficking drugs, they did a huge amount of extortion, kidnapping, piracy, theft of oil, human smuggling, human trafficking, and all kinds of other crimes, and really raised the bar in terms of the violence.
Was their leader caught recently?
Yes. Their leader, known as Z3, who was their leader for a long time, the executioner, was supposedly killed in October last year, although his body was then stolen back by his people, which then raises the big doubts about, oh my God, you know, we haven't got the corpse. His second in command, his right hand man, the top lieutenant known as Z40, Miguel Treviño, was arrested in July,
right.
and is now in prison awaiting trial in Mexico.
Right.
Besides these two major groups, there's also another. Depending on how you define cartels, another seven or so other important cartels in Mexico, including, you know, one which is getting a lot of attention is the Knights Templar cartel. You know, with strangely taking the name from the defenders of Jerusalem in the Crusades, this kind of Catholic order of knights, the Knights Templar, who are big in moving crystal meth among things. You've also got other groups. It's still the old Juarez cartel, Tijuana cartel, Gulf cartel, Beltran Leyva organization, Jalisco New Generation, the other important groups in parts of Mexico who have often deals with the Sinaloa cartel or the Zetas or other complicated system of alliances spreading around the country.
Yep. And what about the plazas? I mean, the plazas are their mechanism to get things into the United States or into Mexico from other places.
Yeah, that's right. The term plaza obviously is referring to a square, la plaza, was used before to talk about the jurisdiction of a particular police command. The police command would have the federal police command would divide into the plazas of their particular jurisdictions. Like they would say their plaza was Tijuana. They were operating, you know, controlling Tijuana, and then it got kind of expropriated by the drug cartels. To be their own place they would control, like which drug cartel controls which plaza. And this is particularly important when you get to the U.S.-Mexico drug trade. What's different from the U.S.-Mexico drug trade as opposed to the drug trade in many other parts of the world is you have this real flashpoint of the border where you have this 2,000-mile border where almost all the drugs are passing through into the United States. And you create real bottlenecks that are worth incredible amounts of money, billions of dollars. So whereas the drug trade in many parts of the world can be very disparate and money is moving here and there and drugs are moving here and there, like a strange kind of octopus, in the Mexico-US trade, you have this flashpoint, a place like Juarez, Tijuana, Nuevo Laredo, a city is worth billions of dollars to drug traffickers. So these plazas become places, territories, which they fight over. You know, who can control the plaza? Whoever can control that plaza can control billions of dollars.
And that pretty much leads into the major conversation everyone's having is the number of people who are dying over there at the moment. They were always hearing about Juarez, but it's not just Juarez where the killing's taking place. So how big is this war that's going on? How many people are dying and what are they actually fighting over?
Well, it's always difficult in any war to know the real numbers of dead. And then particularly in a conflict like in Mexico, where many people even deny there's an armed conflict going on, say this is simply a criminal problem like the U.S. suffered in the Bronx or whatever. But there's been reasonable counts done by both the media and the government intelligence services. They've try to make estimates and calculate the number of people who seem to be killed by either organized crime by the cartels or by the security forces, fighting the cartels, but security forces, the army, the federal police, the Marines have killed thousands of people as well. And you see that, you know, the Mexico before this virus exploded, there was only in 2007 about 7,000 murders in Mexico. And you compare that to 2011, for example, there was about 27,000 murders in Mexico. So, you know, a huge increase. Some of the reasonable counts have counted around 60 to 70,000 people who have died in this cartel-related violence in the last 6 years.
It's sort of like the death rate in Syria. It's quite amazing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sure. I mean, Syria's happened short time, but yeah, certainly it's comparable to many war zones around the world. Many wars that have happened, many declares, many of the civil wars in Central America. It's not as intense as other wars as the, you know, high intensity wars. It's a low intensity armed conflict, which happens in certain parts of Mexico in certain times. So you still have in Mexico a very varying situation. You have in Yucatan Peninsula, for example, in the Yucatan state, which is close to where many people go on holiday to Cancun and so forth. It has the same murder rate as Belgium. It has a fairly low murder rate. And really, there's, you know, you don't want to wear an armed conflict there. In Mexico City, in the capital where I'm at now, right now, you have a similar murder rate to Boston in the United States. It's not as bad as New Orleans. It's not as bad as Detroit. However, you still have, I mean, right now, Guerrero is a very, you know, bad state. Acapulco, you have in Acapulco, one of the worst murder rates of any city in the world. I mean, it's, you know, murder rates that are extremely high, and still other places. And this violence moves around. The flashpoint moves around with Michoacán state, Tamaulipas state, and it's a violence which often involves, you know, large armed groups. It can have armed groups of as many as 50 people, or in some firefights, there's been, you know, hundreds of people engaging the military
with large weapons too.
Yeah, with the weaponry. The biggest killer in this conflict has been the automatic rifle, the AK-47, or the versions of the Kalashnikov, also because it's been the AR-15. But as well as that, many fragmentation grenades and rocket-propelled grenades are also being launched and used. Bell-driven machine guns, 50 calibers, and that kind of thing. So again, the kind of weaponry often used by insurgent forces, by guerrilla forces around the world. It's not so much airplanes and tanks fighting as these kind of small guerrilla weapons being used.
Yep. But I think we'll spend the rest of the time talking about the really quite bizarre cultural aspects of this and how this has flowed out through the community. We'll start off with the narco ballots. I'd never seen one. I always assumed they were very small-scale things, but I went to a lecture recently at a conference where a guy was playing a few, and they're very high-quality production, some of them.
Yeah, that's correct. Well, some of the bands are on major record labels in the United States as well. Many of these groups are based in the U.S. now.
Really?
In Los Angeles, obviously a big place, a huge audience among Mexicans living in the U.S. and Mexican-Americans. Mostly, the tradition of the ballad itself has you know, historical roots in Mexico. You can take this back to the balladeers who told stories about the Mexican War of Independence, or later the Mexican Revolution, and very many famous ballads about the Mexican Revolution, about Pancho Villa and Emiliano Zapata and these people who fought the Mexican Revolution. And they were seen as a way of kind of telling stories, a folk way of exchanging news, of talking about figures. And quite interesting music form in that sense. There was one group, Los Tigres del Norte, one of the founders of this genre, who formed in the late 60s and in the early 70s started recording ballads on vinyl and kind of bringing in like an electric bass and a kind of pumping drum, and they're kind of making this kind of new sound, which kind of defined really from then the corrido sound. And one of their first narco ballads was back in 1970, 3, I believe, telling the story of a woman who carried some marijuana in car tires into the United States and then had the shootout when it was delivered. And then later on, you know, that ballad became very popular. And later on, you know, moving forward to the 90s, when you had things like hip-hop in the United States, you started getting much more kind of radical drug ballad figures like Chelino Sanchez, who was more like the kind of Tupac Shakur of drug ballads, who was quite a crazy figure, who'd been in prison, and even at a concert in the United States, somebody got a gun out and tried to shoot him, and he pulled out a gun and started firing back, and there was a big shootout at a concert. He was eventually murdered in Mexico, in Sinaloa State. He's from Sinaloa. And he kind of defined the hardcore kind of gangster drug ballad sound. And then moving on now to the more recent conflict, you've had, you know, super hardcore bands. One I profile in the book, their name is El Grupo Cartel de Sinaloa. So that's he called, you know, the Cartel de Sinaloa group. And, you know, no difficulty guessing which cartel they're kind of sympathetic to. And, you know, they're very tied, very close. And the cartels would actually pay these people to write songs about them. A gangster will say, I want you to write a song about me. Write about how I'm a great drug trafficker, how I move loads of heroin, how I move loads of cocaine, how I make loads of money, how I've got loads of people who follow me with guns. And these people will charge, okay, I will charge you $10,000 or $5,000 to write this song about you. And then, you know, these bands also often play at their parties, play at these lavish parties of drug traffickers. And as well as being you know, still very popular with people around the country, and there's a defense. I mean, I personally don't think it's worth trying to censor the music. There's an effort now to try and censor this music in Mexico. It's very hard to play on the radio. They recently fined some promoters in Mexico for having a concert of narco corridos. And I think trying to censor it is not necessarily the answer. I don't think censoring music will necessarily stop violence. I think the root cause can be found in other places.
Yep. So the support for it, is this very much like a Robin Hood type of thing?
Yeah, that's certainly true. And that's a big theme I discuss a lot in the book is how drug cartels are seen within these communities. And one truth, unfortunate truth, is that to many people in these areas, they see drug trafficking and the cartels as being a career choice in life, as being one of the few options available to them. And some of these figures try and hold themselves up as being Robin Hood figures who are only taking drug money, you know, from the Americans, and they, you know, giving out presents to orphanages and this kind of thing, giving kind of supporting charity. Some of that image has been stained in recent years with the level of violence that's happened.
Yeah,
People have started to realize, well, maybe they're not really rebels fighting the system as much as being oppressive criminal warlords in their own right. You know, they've started to become almost an authority themselves, but still they like to portray themselves or see themselves often as the kind of a desperado, if not the good guys, at least the kind of lovable bad guys.
Yeah. And there is a drug market in Mexico. I mean, there are local customers.
There's a growing drug market in Mexico. There's a lot of use of crack cocaine, a lot of use in heroin in certain parts, and a lot of use crystal meth in certain parts, and obviously a large use of marijuana. There's a growing market and use of drugs here as well, and that's going to that has big implications for how to deal with drugs here in the future.
Let's turn to the religious side now. You've touched on it earlier, but there's the normal church religious process that's going on in the community, and then this brand new religious one you're talking about, the ones that are the religious justifications for some of the cartels?
That's correct, yeah. There's various strands of the narco religion. One in Sinaloa is this folk saint called Jesus Malverde, Jesus Malverde. Who's a folk saint who supposedly a bandit killed just before the outbreak of the Mexican Revolution in 1909. And he's had a shrine to him in the Sinaloa state capital, which many drug traffickers do venerate, and many of them see him as a man of the people, and pray to him before trafficking over the border. Kind of as many ballads as well, alluding to him, to him as somebody who brings wealth in terms of drugs. Then there's this figure, the Santa Muerte, the Holy Death, who's a kind of a strange character, this female Grim Reaper, often dressed up in elaborate clothes. And there's been a real explosion of folk interest in her, of working class Mexicans having shrines, having symbols of the Holy Death, Santa Muerte, and many drug traffickers are among them. And people who have found shrines to the Santa Muerte in houses of various drug traffickers, and sometimes with people who have been decapitating victims have been around. So there's been a lot of attacks on her from the church, Catholic church, saying it's a heresy to follow her.
The decapitations become quite a theme
They do. Yeah, I mean, the way the violence has been expressed in Mexico has been particularly brutal and has really caught the world attention. There's been an enormous amount of decapitations, some 400 a year in recent years. Rolling heads into nightclubs and restaurants, leaving heads in ice boxes, chopping up bodies, cutting up face and sewing onto a soccer ball, all kinds of weird stuff. And part of this is a psychology of trying to sow terror for the cartels and the soldiers of the cartels, trying to control the places, trying to control the territories. They see the best way to try and strike terror at the population, try and show themselves as being the most ruthless, most powerful group there. And if you strike terror to people there, then they won't resist, and you can try and effectively control the territory.
Mm-hmm. And what's going to happen in the future? I mean, we're at this point now that's been, it's just been growing progressively for the last 20 years. Is it going to continue to grow, or is there any action being taken by government to try and reduce it?
Well, you've had a couple of things that have happened. One is that this great military offensive by the government under Felipe Calderón came to an end with Felipe Calderón leaving office in December 2012. His party, the candidate for his party, won third place in the election, so very badly, and the failure of the drug war was part of that. And this new president came in, that the PRI are back in, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, who ruled Mexico for most of the 20th century, are back in power now. And they've now changed the discourse, changed the dialogue, and said, oh, now we want to just reduce violence, reduce extortion, reduce kidnapping. This whole idea of a war against the cartels has kind of come to an end. But they still face the daily reality of armed groups run by cartels confronting the military, overrunning towns. They're still keeping the military in parts of the country and haven't really got a great new idea on how to handle this. But we have seen, it seems, a kind of plateauing, at least, of the violence. We saw this explosion and a sharp increase of violence between 2007 and 2011, where every year it was like multiplying. And around 2010, 2011, things were very scary. People didn't know where this was going. And now it seems to have plateaued. It seems to have kind of leveled in most of the places. We still have a very high level of violence, but it seems to have stopped getting worse and worse. And the government is simply trying to contain it in certain areas and trying to stop it, setting the agenda of the whole country, trying not to talk about it too much, trying to change the media conversation. And there was something very interesting coming up. A new breath in the discussion about the war on drugs, which really kickstarted in November last year when Washington State and Colorado in the United States legalized marijuana. Mm. And now we've got in Uruguay a whole country which is poised to legalize marijuana. Perhaps this kind of domino effect where a whole bunch of countries are going to start legalizing marijuana first of all, and a kind of a whole new discussion perhaps about the war on drugs and about the failures of the war on drugs and how the war on drugs has only led to drug wars on the scale of Mexico has been, you know, one of the most brutal drug wars in history. Mm-hmm. So this could be an interesting discussion we're going to have. We're having now, we're going to be having over the next few years. Perhaps we need to redefine the whole way we deal with drugs, narcotics, and find a way which works better and doesn't give billions of dollars to these extremely violent criminal kingpins.
Yeah. So it's a problem that doesn't have an easy solution. It's not like we just haven't had the person with the political will to go and do this particular thing. There's no straightforward answer to the whole issue of the violence and the drugs in Mexico.
There's no magic bullet. I personally think there's three areas we can focus on to try and move forward on this, three main areas internationally. One is, I think, a rethinking of the war on drugs, legalization of marijuana, trying to look at how we can contain more harder drugs through, you know, much better rehabilitation and this kind of thing. Second important thing is how can we stop or how can we help communities that have been so marginalized? In Mexico, you know, I interviewed some kids in the book who commit murders for about $85 a murder. Now you've got to see a real degeneration of communities to allow this to happen. You know, how is it somebody could take a human life for $85? See, you know, teenagers who see nothing, have got no opportunities, only the cartels come to them and offer them something. So there's some interesting projects that's been around Latin America. In Medellin, in Colombia, there was a mayor there who tried to revive the city of Medellin, who said we've got to really improve the areas. The most beautiful buildings have to be built in the worst areas of the city. We've got to, you know, really try and, you know, you can't just leave, abandon these communities. And there's some interesting things that come out of Palermo, Sicily. The mayor there talking about how as well, about how you try and revive communities. So many things, kind of social work needs to be done over a long term. And then the third thing is, how do you build a justice system which works? I mean, one of the reasons that cartels have killed thousands upon thousands of people is because they get away with murder. You know, we saw some horrific things in Juarez. In 2010, there was more than 3,000 homicides. And only about 5% of those were solved. Even then, we don't really know if they got the right people. So 1 in 20. So 19 times they're getting away with murder. So when you have that happening, that's a real problem. So how can you build a justice system which works? Very, very tough issue in Mexico. And a very tough issue in many countries around the world. All these issues, I think, in Mexico are important because these are, that reflect many countries around the world. In the Americas, in Africa, in Western Europe, or in Eastern Europe, but also in rich countries. And in rich countries, we also see problems as well with marginalization, with drugs, with organized crime, and so forth. You know, I'm sure in Australia, in the United States, and so forth. But how do you build a justice system which works? How can you have a rule of law which works? And that's a real tough issue in many countries around the world. How can we have rule of law which works in these places?
Yeah. Okay, so you've done all this work. You've written this book, as you said at the beginning. You wrote it as an opportunity to put all these ideas together in one place. Are you planning to write another book? Or
I am, yes. I'm working on a second book. Now I have another contract with the same publishers. Again, with Harry Potter, to help pay the bills. And this is a look at these same issues again, but it's also expanding out. It's looking at some various case studies of organized crime groups who have become like criminal warlords in a couple in Mexico, one in Jamaica, one in Brazil, one in Colombia, and one in Central America, in El Salvador, Honduras area. And looking at the other case studies and taking these ideas forward about the role of these groups of the 21st century, how come the Americas is the most violent, homicidal part of the world?
Yep.
What's led to those and what can we do about it?
Terrific. Look, I'd be very happy to talk to you again when that one comes out as well, so keep me informed on that.
That'll be a pleasure, yeah. Most definitely.
Great. Okay, Ian Grillo, thank you very much for the interview.
Thank you very much.